met a boy, and that the meeting broke her heart. And she does not know that for just one moment, there was a flicker of trust in Arsinoe's eyes. "Where is Elizabeth?" Mirabella asks. "You promised you would not send her away." "And I have not," says Luca. "Not forever. She will be back from her punishment soon. I want to see her as soon as she returns." "Of course, Mira. And she will want to see you. She was most worried." Mirabella purses her lips. Yes, Bree and Elizabeth were most worried, and they were loyal. They did not give her up, even after a dozen welts were put upon their backs. She should have known that would happen, just as she should have known that the temple would condemn Elizabeth as a conspirator the moment Mirabella was found wearing her white cloak. Mirabella said she had stolen it when Elizabeth was not looking. No one believed her. She should have found a way to keep them safe. It will be hard to face Elizabeth when she returns, as it will be hard to face Arsinoe at Beltane, unable to explain how it had all been a mistake. Mirabella grimaces. Thinking of what lies ahead makes her chest tighten. Her only comfort is to relive her nights with Joseph, and even those are sullied by his love for another girl. "He ran to her," she whispers, hardly realizing that she is speaking aloud, like he had not seen her in 100 years. "What?" Luca asks.
"Mirabella, what did you say?"
"Nothing." She holds her hand out toward the warmth of the lamp's flame. One flicker of her finger, and the fire jumps from the wick and onto the back of her hand. Luca observes, pleased as it inches up Mirabella's wrist and around her arm like a curious worm. This is how it will start, slow and warm. The drums will fill her ears. The fire will reach for her, and she will embrace it, let it have the run of her body as she spins with her arms flung out. She will wrap herself in it, like chains, and let it burn. Perhaps it will burn her love for her sisters right out of her heart. Days later, Mirabella is walking through the woods near Westwood House, when she hears a woodpecker rapping on a tree. She looks up. It is a small black and white tufted. Perhaps it is Pepper. She thinks it is him, though to her one woodpecker tends to look much like the next. "Keep to the path, Queen Mirabella." One of the priestess escorts nudges her back to the center, as if she would try to run, surrounded as she is. There are 6 of them now, and all young and fit. When the wind moves their cloaks, it reveals the silver glint of their mean, serrated knives. Had the priestesses always carried those? Mirabella does not think so. Certainly not so many, and not so often. Now it seems that every initiated priestess wears them. "How things have changed," she says. "They have indeed," the priestess says. "And whose fault would that be?" Ahead, the gabled roof of Westwood House rises through the trees, dotted with lightning rods like so many hairs. She cannot wait to get inside. There, she will be free at least to walk the halls. Perhaps she will take tea in to Sarah, as a peace offering. Sarah worried so severely when she ran away. There is so much white now, in her twisted bun. And when Mirabella was returned, she held her so tightly. "Mira!" Bree dashes up to them on the path, brown braids swinging. Her eyes are red, as though she has been crying. "Bree, what is the matter?" Bree shoulders past the priestesses and takes hold of Mirabella's hands. "Nothing," she says, but she cannot mask it. Her expression crumples. "Bree, what is it?" "It is Elizabeth," she says, and rounds on the priestesses with her teeth bared. "I ought to set your robes on fire," she shouts. "I ought to murder you in your sleep." "Bree." Mirabella tugs her friend tight to her side. "We told you she did not have anything to do with it," Bree sobs. "We told you that the cloak was stolen." "What did you do?" Mirabella asks the priestesses, but they seem to be as alarmed as she is. Mirabella and Bree start to run, pushing through the escort. "Do not run, Queen Mirabella." Several try to grab her arms, but the effort is half-hearted. and she wrenches loose. They know where she is going. She and Bree race the rest of the way up the path, out of the trees and around the side of the house. Elizabeth is there in the drive. She stands with her back to them, beside the stagnant stone fountain. The priestesses who accompanied her lower their eyes when Mirabella approaches. Mirabella breathes a sigh of relief. Elizabeth is home. She seems stiff, but she is alive. Elizabeth? Mirabella steps closer. The young priestess half turns. I am all right, she says. It is not so bad. What is not so bad? Mirabella asks, and Elizabeth allows the sleeves of her robes to fall away. They have cut off her left hand. The stump is wrapped in rough white bandages, and blood has soaked through and dried brown. Mirabella stumbles to her friend and drops to her knees, clutching Elizabeth's skirt. No, she moans. They held me down, Elizabeth says. But that was for the best. They used their knives to saw through, you see, and it took more time than with an axe. So it was better that they held me. It felt good to be able to fight and struggle. No, Mirabella shouts, and feels Bree's hand on her back. Elizabeth touches the top of her head. Do not cry, Mira, she says. It was not your fault. But it was. Of course it was. Wolf Spring. She will forgive him soon, Madrigal says, speaking of Jules and Joseph. As angry and as hurt as she is, she misses him more. And I believe him when he says he loves her. I don't think he has smiled once since she sent him away. How do you know? Arsinoe asks, and Madrigal shrugs. Because I have been down to the docks, she says. I have seen him working. All frowns. Not even your Billy can make him laugh. Arsinoe's lips curl despite herself when Madrigal calls Billy that. Hers. It is a lie, but it is a funny one. And it is true what Madrigal says. Jules will forgive Joseph soon, and so will Arsinoe. It has not been easy for her, either, to think of him with Mirabella. In some way, it has felt as though he betrayed her, too. It does not suit him. Madrigal sighs. Sandrins are not meant to be so serious, so sad. They were made to laugh and have not a care in the world. He deserves his misery, Arsinoe says. Every cruel word she gives, and some from me besides. Who will take care of Jules if I fail and do not survive? I was counting on him to look after her. I will look after her, Madrigal says, but she does not meet Arsinoe's eyes when she says it. Madrigal has never been good at looking after people, and Jules would never allow her to. I suppose our Jules is perfectly equipped to take care of herself, Arsinoe says, her anger cooling. And perhaps she will never have to try. I still may become queen. You may indeed, Madrigal says. She takes up her small silver knife and passes it through the fire. But the time for waiting is over. Now, we will make something happen. Madrigal picks up a jar filled with dark liquid. It is mostly Arsinoe's blood, both fresh and from the soaked cords she collected before. The cords have been re-wetted with water from the cove. She walks to the trunk of the bent-over tree. What are you doing? Arsinoe asks. Madrigal does not reply. She splashes the jar onto the side of the hill. Across the exposed slabs of sacred stone, across the trunk of the twisted tree and the roots that web through the rocks and bind it there. When she whispers something to the bark, the tree seems to breathe. To Arsinoe's astonishment, coffee-colored buds pop out along the tree's branches like goose flesh. I didn't know it bloomed, she says. It does not, or at least not often. But tonight it must. Give me your hand. Arsinoe walks to the tree and holds out her hand, expecting pain. What she does not expect is for Madrigal to yank her palm against the trunk and drive her knife all the way through it.
Ah, Madrigal! Arsinoe screams. The pain streaks up her arm and into her chest. She cannot move. She is trapped, pinioned, as Madrigal begins to chant. Arsinoe does not know the words, or perhaps it is only that they are spoken too quickly. It is hard to hear anything over the pain of the knife in her hand. Madrigal walks back to the fire, and Arsinoe drops to one knee, trying to fight the urge to tear her hand free. The blade is buried deep into the wood. She pulls on the handle gently, and then harder, but it will not come out. Madrigal, she says through her teeth. Madrigal! Madrigal lights a torch. No, Arsinoe shouts. Leave me alone. Madrigal's face is determined in a way that Arsinoe has never seen before. She does not know if Madrigal means to fuse her hand to the tree, but she does not want to find out. She takes a breath, preparing to pull loose, even though it will mean cutting between the bones of her middle fingers. Quick as lightning, Madrigal reaches forward and yanks the knife out of the trunk. Arsinoe scrambles back, hugging her hand to her chest as Madrigal sets the tree alight. It ignites in bright yellow flames and reeks of burning blood. Arsinoe falls over, and the world goes dark. That night, in a bed she has no recollection of returning to, Arsinoe dreams of a bear, a great brown bear with long curved claws and pink and purple gums. She dreams of it roaring before a scalded, bent-over tree. It is barely dawn when Arsinoe shakes Jules gently awake, evoking growls from both the girl and the cougar who shares her pillow. Arsinoe? Jules asks. What is it? Are you all right? I'm better than all right. Jules squints at her in the pale blue light. Then why are you waking me so early? For something grand, Arsinoe says and grins. Now get up and get dressed. I want to fetch Joseph and Billy, too. It does not take long for Jules to get dressed and washed and to gather her unruly waves into a thick piece of ribbon at the nape of her neck. They are out of the house and on the road into town long before anyone else begins to stir, even Grandma Kate. Jules did not object when Arsinoe wanted to bring Joseph, but when they reach his house, she will not go up to knock. Arsinoe finds that she does not want to either. Eager as she is to reach the bent-over tree, she feels guilty, and oddly shy, disturbing the Sandrin so early. But just as she is about to gather pebbles to shoot at Joseph's window, Matthew comes through the door. He startles when he sees them. Then he smiles. What are you two about at this hour? Nothing, Arsinoe says. We're looking for Joseph. Is he awake?
Only just, says Matthew. I'll get him moving for you.
And the mainlander too, Arsinoe calls after him as he goes back inside. When they come out, Jules says, leaning against her mountain cat, will you tell me what we are doing here? Perhaps it is a surprise, Arsinoe says. She paces around Jules. Arsinoe's blood is up, and not even the loosely wrapped hole in her hand causes her any pain. But she is still hesitant to say what she has seen. She is afraid Jules will tell her it was only a dream, and she is afraid that Jules would be right. It seems like forever passes before the boys come out, looking confused and bedraggled. Joseph brightens when he sees Jules. Billy smooths his hair when he sees Arsinoe, and Arsinoe coughs to cover her smile. Billy has not seen her since he returned from meeting Katarine, and even though she would not admit it, she was worried that he would return devoted to the poisoners.
This is a welcome sight, Billy says. Did you miss me so much that you had to see me the moment I arrived back in Wolf Spring?
I thought you had been back for days, Arsinoe lies, and I am not here for you, but for Joseph.
I heard you call for me. The mainlander too. I'm not deaf.
Arsinoe says nothing. She is too busy watching Joseph stare at Jules, and Jules stare at her cougar.
Arsinoe, are you listening to me? I said, where are we going?
North, she says distractedly, into the woods. Then we'll pass by the Lion's Head. I'll buy us some food. I don't really want to stop.
But stop you will, says Billy, if you want my company. You are dragging us out before breakfast.
They drag the Lion's Head kitchen boy out before his breakfast as well, and it takes longer than usual for fried eggs and rashers of bacon doused in beans. Arsinoe is antsy all through the meal, though she does manage to eat her entire plate and part of Jules's besides. Afterward, she leads them on a curving path through the alleys and streets of Wolf Spring, taking the most direct route to the tree. She bends her arm to elevate her wounded hand. It has begun to throb. Perhaps that is a good omen. Or perhaps she should have brought Madrigal. It may have been only a dream, after all, and she is leading them through the melting snow for nothing. When they are a good distance into the trees, Jules recognizes the direction they are heading in and stops.
Tell me, Arsinoe, she says. Tell me now.
What? Joseph asks her. What's wrong? Where is she taking us?
It's more low magic, Jules replies. She looks at Arsinoe's freshly wounded hand. Isn't it?
I still don't understand what's so different about low magic, Billy says and looks at Jules, and what you do with that cougar.
It is different, Joseph says. Jules's gift belongs to her. Low magic is for anyone. You, me, even back home we could do it. But it's dangerous, and it's not for queens.
Wait, Billy says.
You're saying that back home, you could have...
He makes a twirling motion with his wrist that Arsinoe does not like. Joseph nods, and after a moment, Billy shrugs.
That's not possible, he says, and I can't imagine you doing spells. You're like my own brother.
What does that matter? Arsinoe asks.
It doesn't, Billy says quickly. I don't know, I know I have met Luke and Ellis and so many other men, but
spells?
I suppose I thought that spells were still only for girls.
Why would they be only for girls? Arsinoe asks, but she cannot really blame him for not knowing.
Never mind that now, Jules says.
Arsinoe, answer the question. Why are you bringing us to that place?
Because I saw my familiar, Arsinoe says.
Jules and Joseph straighten. Even Camden pricks her black-tipped ears. Arsinoe holds up her hand and unrolls the bandages to reveal the angry, red-crusted wound that runs all the way through the center of her palm.
We used my blood. I was bound to the tree, and we woke my gift.
Madrigal. Somehow she must have known that in that sacred place we would be heard, if only my blood would soak into the roots.
It sounds like madness, but she was there. She felt something pass through her and into the trunk, into the stones, and into the island. There, beneath the bent-over tree, as in so many other places, the island is more than just a place. There, it breathes and it listens.
What did you see? Jules asks. And where?
In my dream, last night. A bear. A great brown bear.
Jules makes a soft, astonished sound. To have a great brown as a familiar would make Arsinoe the strongest naturalist queen the island has ever seen, stronger than Bernadine and her wolf, perhaps stronger even than Mirabella and her lightning. Jules does not want to believe in Arsinoe's use of low magic, but even she cannot help hoping.
Are you certain? Jules presses.
I am not certain about anything, Arsinoe says. But that is what I saw, what I dreamed.
Can it be true? Joseph asks.
Arsinoe clenches her injured fist, and the tenuous scabs give way to leak more blood, as though that might make it so.
The temple might rethink their backing of Mirabella, Joseph says.
Would that bother you? Jules asks. She turns to Arsinoe. Perhaps he should not be here. Perhaps he should not come.
I only meant that nobody cares whether the new queen is an elemental or a naturalist, Joseph says softly, as long as she is not a poisoner.
Jules frowns,
She does not move, even though Arsinoe paces loops in the direction of the tree.
It can't hurt, can it? Billy asks.
He takes a few steps after Arsinoe.
To go look.
Arsinoe claps him on the shoulder. Right you are, Junior. Let's go. She moves quickly through the trees, picking her way across lingering snow and patches of melting ice. She does not look back. Even though she cannot hear Jules's and Camden's silent feet, she knows they are there. Whether she approves or not, Jules would never let her go alone. As they near the tree, the image of the bear hangs behind Arsinoe's eyelids. Even in the dream, it was enormous. It blotted out everything else. In her mind, it is only shining brown fur and a roar. White fangs and curved black claws long enough to disembowel a running deer. It will be a tame bear, won't it? Billy asks.
As tame as Camden is tame, Joseph says.
Not tame at all, then, Jules says, but not a danger to friends.
That cat is tamer than half of my mother's spaniels, says Billy, but I can't imagine a bear behaving the same.
They round the curve of the hill to the sunken patch of land before the bent-over tree and the ancient surfaces of the sacred stones. The tree is intact. The night before, it had seemed to explode in yellow fire, but the only mark it bears is a charred patch stretching from the trunk to the lowest branches. Its limbs are free of the buds that Arsinoe remembers Madrigal blooming, and every drop and spatter of blood is gone, as if it never was, or as if it had been drunk.
What happened here? Jules asks through a grimace.
She steps gingerly around the dormant coals and floats her hand over the blackened part of the trunk. Then she wipes her fingers against her jacket, even though she never touched it.
I think, says Billy, I think that even I feel something, a vibration, almost.
This place feels tired, says Joseph, as if it has been used up.
No, says Jules, it feels like what it is, outside. It is not what the rest of these trees are, not what the rest of this ground is.
Yes, Arsinoe adds breathlessly, that's exactly right.
Prickles rise on the back of Arsinoe's neck. It has never felt quite like this, as if Jules's apprehension and Billy's nerves are leeching into the air.
Was it supposed to be here? Joseph asks. Is this where you saw it?
Yes. It was there, before the tree, roaring as the branches burned behind it. But the branches are not burned, and she has led them all this way for nothing.
How long do we wait? Billy asks. Should we whistle for it?
It is not a dog, Arsinoe snaps. It is not a pet. Just a little longer, please. She turns and searches the trees. There is no sound, no wind and no birds. It is as still and silent as it always is.
Arsinoe, Jules says gently, we should not be here. This was a mistake.
No, it's not, Arsinoe insists.
Jules was not there. She was not the one joined to that tree, bleeding into it. She did not feel the change in the air. Madrigal said that a queen's blood would really be worth something, and she was right. Arsinoe's low magic is strong.
The bear will come, she murmurs. It will come. She begins to walk north.
Arsinoe? Jules asks and takes a step, but Billy puts out his arm.
Give her a moment, he says.
But he follows her himself, keeping his distance as she searches. When it arrives, it is not difficult to spot. The great brown bear is massive and trundling drowsily down the hillside. Its shoulders swing in dismal arcs as it tries to find its way down to her through the close-growing trees. Arsinoe nearly shouts, but something holds her back. The bear does not look the way it did in her dream, with its claws dragging through the mud and its head lolling.
It looks as if someone has pulled it up out of a ditch already dead and forced it back onto its rotting feet.
It will recognize me, Arsinoe whispers, and forces her legs to take a step. Then another. She smells something decaying. The bear's fur moves the way dead fur moves when it is disturbed by colonies of maggots and ants.
Jules, she whispers, and dares to look back. But Jules is too far away. She cannot see.
Arsinoe, come away from it, Billy says. This is madness.
But she cannot. She has called it, and it is hers. She holds out her hand. At first it does not seem to know that she is there. It keeps on lumbering, and to add to its list of wrongs, there is something the matter with its gait. Its left shoulder slams down harder than its right. She sees streaks of red in its paw print. An overgrown claw has dug into its foot, as is common in very old or sick bears.
Is it? Billy asks. Is it your familiar?
No, she says, and the bear's angry, bleary eyes finally meet hers.
Run, she shouts, and turns as the bear roars.
The ground shakes beneath its weight when it comes after her. They race down the hill, and time slows. Several years ago, when she and Jules were children, a farmer brought his dead hounds into the square to warn people of a rogue bear. A hunting party found and killed it a few days later. It had only been a common black, but those hounds had barely looked like hounds anymore, split from nose to tail by the common black's claws. All these years later, Arsinoe remembers the way one dog's jaw dangled by the tiniest piece of skin. Mud from the bear kicks up around her shoulders. She is not going to make it. Jules screams and runs toward her, but Joseph grabs her around the waist. Good boy. He cannot let her risk herself. He has to look after her, the way Arsinoe always knew that he would. Arsinoe's foot slides in the mud, and she falls forward onto her face. She closes her eyes. Any moment, and the claws will tear through the backs of her legs. What's left of her blood will stain the ground.
Hey! Billy shouts. Hey! Hey!
The fool has come closer, right into the bear's sightline. He waves his arms and pelts the bear with ice and mud balls he scoops into his hands. They do not do anything besides bounce off, but it gives Arsinoe time to climb to her feet.
Run! He screams. Run, Arsinoe!
But Billy has exchanged her life for his. The bear will be on him in moments. Perhaps he thinks that a worthy trade, but she does not. Arsinoe throws herself between Billy and the bear. It strikes out hard with its paw. The brunt of the force easily pops her shoulder out of the joint. The rest she takes across her face. Red paints the snow in drizzles. Camden snarls and races up the hill to collide with the great brown in a blur of golden fur. Billy wraps his arm around Arsinoe's ribs and heaves her up.
It's hot and cold, she mumbles, but cannot get her mouth to work properly.
Come on, Billy says, and Jules cries out.
Camden wails pitifully. She stops abruptly when she is thrown hard against a tree.
No,
Arsinoe screeches. But the sound is barely heard over Jules screaming, louder and louder, until it hardly sounds like her voice. The great brown begins to shake its head, and then to paw at itself. It scratches at its chest, like it is trying to claw out its own heart. For an instant, in the midst of Jules's shouts, it seems that the bear hovers in midair. Then it falls over, dead. Sweat rolls off Jules as though it is the middle of Wolf Spring summer, and she collapses onto one knee. The bear is dead, its great paws flung out on all sides. It lies still and looks almost peaceful now, no longer too old and too sick, but out of its misery.
Jules, Joseph says, and crouches beside her.
He puts his arm across her shoulders and turns her face to his. Are you all right?
Yes, she says. She takes a breath. She's fine.
And whatever she used to kill the bear, to explode its heart inside its chest, has gone. Perhaps back into the heart of the gnarled, bent-over tree.
Cam, she says. Arsinoe?
I know, says Joseph. He runs through the trees up the hill to where Arsinoe and Camden lie. Billy has torn the sleeves from his shirt and tied tight strips around Arsinoe's upper arm. He presses the rest of the cloth hard to her face.
She didn't have enough blood to begin with, he growls. We have to get her to a doctor, now.
There aren't any, Joseph says quietly. There are healers.
Well, whatever they have here, Billy snaps. She needs them.
They'll be at the temple, says Jules, coming close to kneel beside them, or at their houses in town.
Oh, goddess, the blood.
The houses are closer, aren't they?
You can't panic now, Jules, you have to listen. This cheek here is going to bleed like crazy, and the snow will make it look like more.
Can you help, or will you faint? Billy asks.
I will not faint.
Can we risk moving her? Joseph asks.
We don't have a choice, says Billy. The bleeding is too severe, I can't stop it.
He and Joseph look at each other gravely over Arsinoe's body. Jules can hardly see. Her tears rise so quickly. Billy said she should not panic, but she cannot help it. Arsinoe looks so pale.
All right, Billy says. Get under her hips and legs. I've got her shoulders and I have to keep pressure on her face.
Jules does as she is told. Warm blood coats her hands almost instantly.
Joseph, she says. Camden, please don't leave Camden.
I won't, he says, and kisses her quickly. I promise.
Jules and Billy carry Arsinoe through the trees, back down the path. Joseph follows behind with Camden across his shoulders. The big cat groans softly. When Jules glances over her shoulder, Cam is licking his ear. By the time they reach Wolf Spring, all are exhausted. The first healer's house is not more than 4 streets away, but they are not going to make it.
The Wolverton, Billy says, and gestures with his chin.
He kicks at the door until it opens and he shouts at Mrs. Castile until there are running feet everywhere.
Isn't there anyone of any use in this town? Billy bellows.
They set Arsinoe on the sofa near the entrance and wait. When the healer finally arrives with 2 priestesses in tow to burn the wounds closed and pull them tight with string, they shove Jules and Billy out of the way.
What is this? One of the priestesses asks. How did she get these wounds?
It was not another attack from Roland. Did Mirabella come again, through the woods?
No, Jules says. It was a bear.
A bear?
We, Jules says, and stops.
Everything happened so quickly. But she should have known. She should have protected her.
We were walking, Joseph says from behind her. We went off the path. The bear came upon us suddenly.
Where? The priestess asks and touches the serrated knife hanging from her hip.
I will send a hunting party.
That isn't necessary, Jules says. I killed it.
You?
Yes, her,
Joseph says with a tone of finality.
Well, her and a mountain cat.
He slips his arm around Jules's waist and turns her away from any more questions. They walk slowly to stand near Billy, who kneels, stroking Camden's head. The cat still cannot walk, but she is purring.
Joseph? Jules asks. They will live, won't they?
You made Camden strong, he says, and squeezes her tightly. And you and I both know that Arsinoe is meaner than any bear.
Greavesdrake Manor. There is no shortage of poison in Greavesdrake Manor. Open any cabinet or drawer, and one is likely to find some powder or tincture or jar of toxic root. It is whispered in the streets of Indrid Down that when the Arryns are ousted, the Westwoods will have the place gutted, that they fear that every wall has been tainted. The fools,
as if the Aarons have been so careless with their craft, as if they would ever be so careless about anything.
Natalia stands before the fireplace in the poison room, taking late morning tea with Genevieve.
Katarine is beyond them, laboring at the tables, mixing and blending in her protective black gloves.
It has finally happened, Genevieve says. The weather has turned and the fire is too hot. You shall have to start opening windows.
Not here, Natalia says. Never here. In this room, the right breeze passing over the wrong powder could instantly mean a dead queen.
Genevieve scowls and half turns in her chair. What is she doing back there?
Working, Natalia replies.
Katarine has always worked very well at her poisons. Ever since she was a child, she bent over the tables and vials with such enthusiasm that Genevieve would drag her away and slap her to try to force more seriousness. But Natalia put a stop to that.
That Katarine takes joy in crafting poisons is the thing about her that Natalia most loves.
Genevieve sighs.
You have heard the news? She asks.
Yes. I assume that is why you have come home, to make sure that I heard the news.
But it is interesting, is it not? Genevieve says.
She sets down her teacup and brushes biscuit crumbs from her fingers and onto her plate.
First, the attempt in the Masthead Woods, and now Arsinoe is near death in her bed?
Behind them, the clattering and clinking goes quiet as Katarine stops to listen.
They say it was a bear attack, Natalia says.
A bear attack? On a naturalist queen? Genevieve narrows her eyes.
Or is Mirabella simply more clever than we assumed? An accidental death like this would not look like a strike against her.
She was not concerned with strikes against her when she left Roland to murder Arsinoe in the forest, Natalia says.
She glances at Katarine.
That attack rattled them all. Masthead is only half a day's ride from Indrid Down. The upstart elemental had come far too close.
Natalia leaves the fireplace and crosses the room to put a hand on Katarine's small shoulder.
The table is a mess. It seems that she has pulled poisons from every shelf and every drawer.
What do you have here, Kat? She asks.
Nothing yet, the young queen replies. It must still be boiled down and concentrated, and then it must be tested.
Natalia looks down at the glass jar, filled with 2 inches of amber liquid.
There is no end to the combinations that can be created here. In many respects, the poison room at Greavesdrake is superior even to the chamber at the Volroy. It is more organized, for one, and it houses many stores of Natalia's own special blends.
Natalia runs her hand fondly across the wood. How many lives has she dispatched from this table? How many unwanted husbands or inconvenient mistresses? So many mainland problems handled here, to honor the alliance and the interests of the king consort.
She reaches for the jar, and Katarine tenses, as if Natalia needs to worry.
Do not spill it on the wood, Katarine explains, blushing. It is caustic.
Caustic? Natalia asks.
Who would require such a poison?
Not Arsinoe, certainly, says Katarine. She may yet have mercy.
Mercy. Genevieve mumbles, listening from her fireside chair.
Mirabella, then? Natalia asks.
They are always saying that she is so beautiful, Katarine says, but that is only skin deep.
She looks up at Natalia so shyly that Natalia laughs and kisses the top of her head.
Natalia.
It is her butler, Edmund, standing straight-backed beside the door.
There is someone here to see you.
Now? She asks.
Yes.
Katarine looks from her poison to Genevieve. She has not finished, but she does not like to stay when Genevieve is there and Natalia is not.
That is enough for today, Natalia says.
She pours the poison deftly into a glass vial and plugs it. Then she tosses it into the air and catches it. When she opens her palms to Katarine, the poison is gone, disappeared up her sleeve. An easy trick. And always good for a poisoner to learn. She wishes that Katarine were better at it.
I will keep it for you to finish later.
Natalia's visitor waits for her in her study. It is not an unfamiliar face, but it is unexpected. It is William Chatworth, the father of the first suitor, already seated in one of her wing-back chairs, her favorite one. "May I offer you a drink?" she asks.
"I brought my own," he says.
He reaches into his jacket and shows her a silver flask. His eyes pass over her bar with contempt. They linger on her brandy, infused with hemlock and with a handsome black scorpion suspended near the bottom.
"That was not necessary," she says. "We always keep stores of untainted goods for guests." "And how many have you accidentally poisoned?"
"None of any consequence," she says, and smiles. "We have partnered with mainlanders for 3 generations and never poisoned one who did not already have it coming. Do not be so paranoid." In the chair, Chatworth has a familiar, drapey air, as if he owns it. He is just as handsome and arrogant as he was when they first met, all those years ago. She leans down and slides her hand over his shoulder and onto his chest.
"Don't," he says. "Not today."
"All business, then. I suppose I am disappointed." She sinks into the chair opposite. William is a very good lover. But every time she beds him, he seems to think less of her, as if she gives something during the bedding that she does not take back afterward.
"I do love the way you talk," he says.
She sips her drink. He may love the way she talks. He also loves the way she looks. His eyes never stop moving over her body, even now, as he discusses business. For mainland men, all roads with women lead somehow right back between their legs.
"How did you find my son?"
he asks. "He is a fine young man," Natalia says. "Charming, like his father. He seemed very fond of Wolf Spring."
"Don't worry," Chatworth says. "He will do as he's told. Our agreement is still in place."
Their agreement. Struck so long ago when Natalia required somewhere for Joseph Sandrin to be banished to. Her friend and lover had been an easy choice. She was not able to kill the Sandrin boy as she would have liked, but she would not be denied everything. There is always something to be gained if one looks hard enough.
"Good," she says. "It will be well worth it for him to obey.
The trade agreements alone will elevate your family beyond reckoning."
"Yes," he says. "And the rest?"
Natalia finishes her brandy and rises to pour another.
"You are so squeamish," she says and chuckles.
"Say the words. Assassinations, murders, poisonings."
"Don't be vulgar."
It is not vulgar. But she sighs. "Yes," she says, "and the rest." She will kill whoever needs killing, discreetly and from great, untraceable distance, as long as their alliance holds. Just as she has, and the Aarons have, for every King Consort's family.
"But why have you come?" she asks.
"So urgent and unexpectedly. It cannot have been just to rehash old bargains."
"No," he says. "I'm here because I've learned a secret that I don't like. One that could end all of our well-laid plans."
"And what is that?"
"I've just come from Rolanth, brokering a meeting between my son and Queen Mirabella. And Sarah Westwood told me a secret that I don't think you know."
Natalia snorts. "That is unlikely. The island is good at remaining hidden, but terrible at hiding anything from her."
"If it is from Sarah Westwood, you have wasted your horse's legs," Natalia says. "She is nothing but a sweet woman, sweet and devout. And 2 more useless words I have never heard." "Most of Fenburn is devout," Chatworth says. "If you had 1 ear to your temple, you wouldn't need me to tell you what I'm telling you now."
Natalia's eyes flash. If she dips her letter opener into her brandy, she can stab him in the neck. It will be a race to see whether he dies of the poison or the blood loss.
"They're planning to assassinate the queens," he says.
For a moment, the words sound so ridiculous that Natalia cannot process his meaning.
"What?"
she asks.
"Of course they are. We all are. No, says Chatworth. I mean the temple, the priestesses. After your ceremony at the festival, they're going to ambush us. They're going to kill our queen and the one from Wolf Spring. She called it a sacrificial year. A sacrificial year, Natalia repeats. A generation of two weak queens and one strong. No one doubts the truth of that. But she has never heard of the weak queens being slaughtered by priestesses at the quickening ceremony. Luca, she whispers, how clever you are. Well, Chatworth says and leans forward in his chair. What are we going to do? Natalia shakes her head and then affixes a bright smile to her face. We are not going to do anything. You have already done your part. Let the Arryns handle the temple. Are you sure? He asks. What makes you think that you can? Only that we have, for the last 100 years. Wolf Spring. When Arsinoe wakes, she knows there is something wrong with her face. At first she thinks that she has slept wrong, perhaps pressed too hard into the pillow, except that she is lying on her back. The room is quiet and bright as midday. She does not know how long she has been asleep. The blue and white curtains are drawn closed. Plates of untouched food crowd the writing desk. The bear, she whispers. Jules appears beside her, tired, her brown hair a wavy mess of tangles. Don't move, she says, but Arsinoe pushes herself onto her elbows. When she does, her right shoulder screams. Let me help, at least. Jules pulls her up and stacks pillows behind her back. Why aren't I dead? Arsinoe asks. Where is Camden? She is all right, Jules says. She is there. She nods toward where the cougar lies on Jules's bed. The big cat appears to be lounging in relative ease. She has a few cuts, and one of her forelegs is wrapped and held in a sling, but it could have been worse. Her shoulder is broken, Jules says quietly. By the time anyone thought to tend to her, it will never heal right. This is my fault, Arsinoe says, and Jules looks down. You could have been killed, Jules says. Madrigal should never have taught you. She was only trying to help me. It is not her fault that something went wrong. We all know that they do, sometimes, with low magic. We all know of the risk. You say that like you are going to do it again, anyway. Arsinoe frowns, or she tries to. Her mouth will not work properly, and her cheek is odd and heavy. There is a part of her face that she can no longer feel, as if a stone has grown into the skin. Will you open a window, Jules? Of course. She walks to the other side of the room to push back the curtains. The fresh air is a relief. The room smells stagnant, like blood and too much sleep. Luke was here, Jules says. He brought cookies. Arsinoe reaches up to her face and strips the bandages. Arsinoe, don't. Get me a mirror. You have to stay in bed, Jules says. Don't be thick. Bring me one of Madrigal's. For a moment, it seems that Jules will refuse. That is when the first real fear sets in. But eventually she goes to ransack Madrigal's dresser until she finds a mirror with a pretty pearlescent handle. Arsinoe runs her good hand over her black cap of hair, smoothing it where it sticks up from having rested on her pillow. Then she raises the mirror and looks. She does not blink, not even when Jules begins to cry behind her hand. She has to make herself see it, every inch of stitched together red, every angry black knot that holds together what is left of her face. Most of her right cheek is gone, hollow where it should be plump. Lines of dark stitches cross from the corner of her mouth to below the outside edge of her eye. Another larger line of stitches covers the hollow of her cheekbone, all the way down to her chin. Well, she says,
A hair's breadth higher, and I would have needed to wear an eye patch.
She starts to laugh. Arsinoe, stop.
She watches the stitches pull in the mirror until blood spurts down her chin. Jules tries to calm her and calls for Kate and Ellis, but Arsinoe only laughs harder. The cuts stretch open. The salt from her tears burns. It is a lucky thing that she never cared about what she looked like. Jules finds Joseph in his family's shipyard, sifting through a tangled mess of rope and rigging. It is a warm day, and he has taken his jacket off and rolled up the sleeves of his shirt. She watches him dismally as he wipes sweat from his brow. He is the kind of handsome that draws every eye.
Jules, he says when he sees her, and sets down his pile of rigging. How is she?
She is Arsinoe, she says. She tore her stitches out. They are putting them back in now. I couldn't stay. I couldn't take any more.
He rubs his fingers clean on a handkerchief. He would take her hand, if he thought she would let him.
I was going to bring her flowers, he says, and chuckles. Can you imagine?
I want to see her, but I don't know if she will want to see me. If she will want to be seen.
She will want to see you, says Jules. Arsinoe will never hide from anything. Jules turns to face the water, obscured by boats in dry dock, barely visible past the edge of the pier. I feel strange, she says, without Camden. Without Arsinoe? As if I've lost my shadows.
They will be back, Joseph says.
Not like they were. Joseph wraps tentative fingers around her shoulder until she leans back into him. For a moment, it seems that he could hold her up, take all her weight in just one hand.
I love her too, Jules, he says, almost as much as I love you.
Together, they look out at the cove. It is quiet, nothing there but low waves and wind, and it seems like you could sail forever.
Joseph? I wish we had gotten her off the island 5 years ago.
Billy does not smile when he comes into the room, and that is good. Or better, at least, than the guilty, shaky, forced grins that the healers and the Malones have been trying to wear. He holds his hand up. He brought her flowers. Vibrant, yellow-orange blooms that do not come from any hothouse in Wolf Spring.
My father sent these, he says. All the way from my mother's favorite florist. He sent for them the moment we heard, before we knew whether you would live or die. He said we could use them either way, for courting or condolences. Shall I stomp on them? In a naturalist house?
She takes them. They have small velvet petals and smell a little like the oranges they import in the summer. They are lovely, she says. Jules will be able to keep them blooming for a long time.
But not you, he says.
No, not me. She sets the flowers on her bedside table, near the windowsill and the dry, curled shell of her dead winter fern. Billy sets his jacket on a chair, but instead of sitting in it, takes a seat at the foot of her bed.
How have you come to be here? He asks. If you are truly without a gift, then why place you with the Malones? Did they win some kind of lottery, or lose one?
Arsinoe chuckles, and pain sparks up the side of her face. Billy leans forward as she holds her cheek, but there is nothing he can do. And besides, the laughter is worth it. It was never said that I was giftless, Arsinoe says. At least not back then. None of us were branded as giftless.
Branded?
The queen knows what she has when she has them, Arsinoe says. Then she leaves us for the midwife to raise. When we are old enough, our families come to claim us. For me, it was Jules. She was the only reason I wasn't terrified. She came along, holding Aunt Kara's hand on one side and Matthew's hand on the other.
Ah, Billy says and leans back.
Aunt Kara and Joseph's brother Matthew. From what I gather, they were a fairly serious item.
They were, says Arsinoe. Some people said she was too serious for him, that he was too young,
but I will never forget his face when they took her away. Arsinoe clears her throat. How ridiculous she must look, bedridden and covered in bandages, talking about lost love.
You jumped in front of that bear for me, he says.
You jumped in front of it for me, first. He smiles a little.
And then Jules killed it, he says. I used to think she was too strong for anyone's good, but we are so lucky that she was there.
Yes, Arsinoe says. I will make sure to have her with me when I try again.
Again? Arsinoe, you were nearly killed.
And if I don't try again, I will be for sure. They lock eyes. Billy looks away first.
The queens just know, he says. What you are.
He shakes his head.
You are so strange in so many ways.
You have heard it said that the queens are not really people, she says. So when we kill one another, it is not a person we are killing. She looks down. That's what they say. I don't know anymore if it is really true.
But true or not, it does not matter. It is the island's way, and it is nearly time to begin.
Beltane arrives with the melt.
Soon the island will begin to move, from the outside in, toward the heart. All the great houses packed together for 3 nights in Innisfool Valley.
A letter arrived from my father yesterday, Billy says, but I have not opened it. I know it will say that I am to go and meet Mirabella, and I don't want to.
You want me to win, Arsinoe says. You want to marry me.
Billy grins. I don't want to marry you. You have none of the proper makings of a wife. But I don't want you to die. You have become my friend, Arsinoe.
He takes her hand and holds it, and she is surprised by how much that means. His words are sincere, even though she knows that, in the end, he will go to meet Mirabella anyway.
Do you want to see it? She touches her face. Are we little boys now? He asks, comparing scabs.
If we were, I would win.
She turns her head and pulls off her bandages. The stitches pull at her cheek, but do not bleed.
Billy takes his time. He sees it all.
Should I lie and tell you that I have seen worse? He asks, and she shakes her head.
There's a rhyme about you, you know, he says, back home. Little girls sing it when they skip rope. 3 black witches are born in a glen. Sweet little triplets will never be friends. 3 black witches, all fair to be seen. 2 to devour, and 1 to be queen. That's what they call you, on the mainland. Witches. That's what my father says that you are. Monsters, beasts. But you are not a monster.
No, she says quietly. And neither are the rest of us. But that doesn't change what we have to do. She takes his hand and squeezes it softly. Go back to the Sandrins, Junior.
Go back and read your letter.
Indrid Down. Peter Reynard has never been invited inside the Volroy, but he has always dreamed of it. Ever since he was a child and his father told him stories. There is nothing in the halls to catch sound, he said. The Volroy defies adornment, as if there are too many other important things inside for it to be bothered with tapestries. Only the chamber where the council meets has anything but smooth black surfaces, and that is a relief sculpture depicting naturalist blooms and elemental fires, poisoner venoms, and the warrior's carnage. He used to sketch the poisoner portion for Peter, charcoal on white paper, a knotted nest of vipers on a bed of oleander petals. He promised to take Peter there as soon as he came of age, but that was before the house in the country and his new wife. This way, says an attendant, who leads Peter up the stairs of the East Tower, where Natalia waits. He does not really need a guide. He has walked the Volroy 1,000 times in his imagination. As they pass a window, he looks out at the West Tower. Huge and hulking, it blots out everything else.
Up close, it does not give the grand impression that it does at a distance, slicing into the sky like an engraved knife. From here, it only looks black and mean and locked up tight until the new